This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show, episode number 789. This is Jason Hartman, your host, and thank you so much for joining me today. So today we have an interview with Dr. Joran Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute, and he's a fascinating guy, has some fascinating stuff to say as it relates to the current world in which we live in terms of economics, in terms of trade, in terms of, well, what does it all mean for real estate, really, is what it all boils down to all the time, because that's what we're into. And as you know, listeners, sometimes we talk about some more heady stuff, some more philosophical stuff, some broad-reaching items, and sometimes we talk about nitty-gritty stuff. Roll up your sleeves, what to actually do, get your hands dirty, talk about investing, very specific techniques. So the shows are meant, the episodes are meant to go back and forth on those issues. So this one is one of those more philosophical shows. But before we get to that, let's talk about a few practical things. I've got a financing offer for you. Yes, a financing offer. So we only have a very, very limited pool of this financing, but we are trying to develop it into a much bigger pool where there may be lots of financing available. And as you all know, the best financing you can get is the conventional Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac type financing. However, if you have exceeded your 10 loan limit, and if you are married and your spouse has exceeded their 10 loan limit, if you are an IRA investor investing with a self-directed IRA, if you are a foreign national who is not a U.S. citizen, but understands how great and how special the U.S. real estate market is, and you want to invest here, if you do not have supremely great credit, if you're one of the many, many millions of people that did some strategic defaults during the Great Recession, where you took that implicit backdoor nuclear option and decided to just walk away from a property, which millions of people did, of course, this is for you. Okay, so yes, there are some cool financing opportunities, and this is better than the hedge fund stuff and the private equity group stuff out there that has really, you know, it's gotten a lot worse. Now, hopefully the pendulum will swing back. It always does. And that financing will become a little bit more attractive. However, right at this very moment, it is not that attractive. So we have a very limited supply of this financing that I'm about to tell you about. So if you are interested, contact your investment counselor. If you're working with one already at my company, then you know who to contact through call or email, whatever you like. If not, go to jasonhartman.com, fill out any web form or inquiry form on our website at jasonhartman.com, and one of our investment counselors will get in touch with you and help you with this very special lowdown, well, relatively speaking, very limited supply financing. So are you ready? Drum roll, please. Here's the financing offer. Limited supply of this, by the way. Now, it's pretty good. It's not as good as your conventional Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac agency type financing. Of course, that's the best thing going. But this is better than anything else I've seen on the market outside of that conventional financing. 6.5% interest rate, only 25% down. So 75% loan to value or loan to purchase price, actually, I should say, and subject to appraisal, of course. 30-year amortization with a balloon in 7 years. 5 points. Now, I know you're thinking, well, that's crazy. Well, it's really not that crazy. It's only about somewhere in the $3,000 range for our typical purchase. And you don't have a whole bunch of fees here. Your fees are only about $1,000 to get this financing versus some of these hedge fund and private equity groups that will fee you to death. You'll have $3,000 in fees plus their points right at the moment. So this is a much better deal than any of that. And your FICO score only has to be 650 or higher. So you do not have to have an extremely good FICO score. And it's a 30-year amortization. So you got nice low payments. It's all due in 7 years. In 7 years, you have time to hopefully get some capital appreciation, some good cash flow. You can refinance the property on my refi till you die plan. In fact, that is a 7-year plan, okay, on the 50% appreciation factor of refi till you die. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to jasonhartman.com, type refi till ya, like YA, till you die. And that's my technique for extracting the wealth from your real estate portfolio in an efficient manner. So that's it. Ask your investment counselor about this very unique financing exclusively here. You don't have it anywhere else. And you can do this with any property in our network. So there you go. There is some special financing available only to our clients. So talk with one of your investment counselors to learn more about that. But basically, that's the outline. That's the deal. Okay? Now, you have heard a lot in the news, and we're going to talk with our guest about it today a little bit, about international trade and about immigration. And I actually disagree with our guest today about some of these issues. I agree philosophically, but not as a practical matter. And folks, you've heard me talk about this. Look, sometimes the practical world, the mechanical world, and the ideological world, the philosophical world, they do not match up. Now, yes, I wish they could always match up and everything would be hunky-dory, but that's just not the way life is, right? There are ideals and philosophies that we strive toward, but as a practical matter, sometimes things don't work out that way, and we got to be realistic. So you know me, for example, I hate inflation. I hate the Federal Reserve. I think it's a big scam. I think our whole banking system's a big scam. I think Wells Fargo sucks, that scandalous company Wells Fargo, and so many of these other banks. I've bashed B of A a lot in the past, so I'm an equal opportunity basher of these companies. But that is another matter, and let's not get on a tangent. And so here's one of those types of things. So you've got this huge controversy over Trump and his temporary immigration ban, right? And everybody's upset. Well, not everybody, but like half the people are upset. But the people that aren't upset, well, they don't have any protests and riots because, well, you know, those people that aren't upset aren't funded by the criminal known as George Soros. The criminal known as George Soros, yes, he funds a lot of these fake protests. So it seems like people are a lot more upset than they really are, right? But that's another tangent. So this immigration ban, you've got all these tech companies that have come out against it, as if they're some great humanitarians because they just want to share the wealth that they have. Yeah, right. Fat chance. They want to share the wealth that America has with the rest of the world. So they want to appear as these altruistic humanitarians. But here's what they really are. I see right through that. They're just the typical greedy capitalist pigs. Okay? That's all they are. They want to hire cheap labor from overseas on, you know, these visa programs where they import a lot of inexpensive, or shall I say less expensive, tech workers to drive Uber cars or to write code or do whatever they do. And this is all great, okay? You know, but you should know the truth. And they want to have cheap labor. But what they really should be doing is they should be paying American workers a reasonable wage so they would do the job. But lest you say, well, Jason, don't be so myopic and don't be so ignorant, because there just isn't a large enough talent pool in America, in the U.S. You know, these people, we need to bring them in from all of these other countries, because in those countries, they are more scientifically oriented. They're more into STEM, S-T-E-M, right? The science and math and all of these engineering type degrees, right? And you would be kind of right about that. But look at this systemic problem. You've got all these people at, well, I'll just use my mom's alma mater, for example, Berkeley, right? All these people at Berkeley that are lighting the school on fire, right, and protesting, and they don't, most of them don't, get degrees in the STEM field, right? Because they're so much more interested in, you know, I don't know, these degrees nobody's actually hiring anybody for, right? So these companies should be setting up programs and working with our universities in the U.S. to train people in science, math, and engineering so that they have a labor pool right here, instead of abandoning the people that are their freaking customers. This is wrong. These people are liars. They are misrepresenting what they are doing. Okay? Now, listen, I'm a greedy capitalist too, just like them. Okay? So I know it takes one to know one, okay? So I have no problem with them if they just come out and say, look, we just want cheap labor, okay? We want cheap, abundant labor. And that's why we're opposing the immigration ban. Fine. At least that would be honest. But they're not being honest, okay? So, you know, what do you think? Are you upset with me for saying this? I don't know. I think I'm speaking the truth. If you think I'm wrong, hey, write me, come on the show, debate it with me. I could be wrong. I'm not always right. I certainly know that. In fact, some of my predictions have been wrong, but a lot of them have been right too. So that's what's really happening behind the scenes, I believe. And I think it's wrong. And I think these people just need to be called out. And they have great companies. They're super innovative. I love them. I love their products. I love their services. And I think that's all totally awesome. But be honest with people. Quit acting like you're some big bleeding heart humanitarian when all you really want is a bunch of cheap labor. And your customers at the large, in the largest consumer market in the world, in the United States, the people that buy your products and services, you owe it to them to hire from that pool, if at all possible. I think that's just reasonable and fair, okay? And, you know, call it protectionist, whatever you want. I agree. Philosophy and practicality do not always meet. And this is one of those times. You know, these people can learn a lot from Henry Ford. Good old Henry Ford. Remember when Henry Ford... Well, you know, Ford Motors, you've heard of them. Model T, you can have any color you want as long as it's black, right? Not a lot of consumer choice back then. Take your black Model T and, you know, enjoy it, right? Your horseless carriage, if you will. And remember when he was considered this generous, sort of innovative, long-term big thinker? And I think a lot of that was true when he raised the wages of his workers, paid them more than the market would dictate he should pay them, so that they could afford to become his customers. Something to think about, big-time tech executives. You have multi-zillion dollar budgets. People have thrown disgusting amounts of money at you, and the least you could do is return the favor and hire people from the same pool that your customers are coming from. Yeah, I know. Some of you are going to think, well, that's so myopic. It's so America-centric. Well, you know, look, It's not America-centric. It would be any country-centric. It doesn't matter what country it is. If the consumers come from one place, then you know what? You should hire in that place, too. You already hire all over the world. We know that. We know that you do that. Okay, you set up factories offshore to save money. You've got trillions of dollars overseas that you won't repatriate to America. And that's partially our politicians' fault because we have, in the past, our administrations have wanted to tax you to death if you bring that money back. I think we should give you a break and let you bring it back and incentivize you to bring it back. So that's a whole nother discussion. But look, enough of that. I just wanted to put that out there. It's some food for thought about this stuff. Inventory of properties, we're back to real estate now, still very scarce. I was happy to offer that very limited but very unique financing offer to you at the beginning of this show. I also wanted to mention, before we get to our guest today, many of you are interested in investing in paper investments. Well, I don't want to say many of you, but you know, a small portion of you are interested in that. And you've invested in the land contract deals that we have, and those have worked out very well from what we can tell for people. I've invested in many of those myself. And, you know, some of you want to balance your portfolio out. You just want to have some paper investments and some real estate investments. Now, all things considered, I like the real estate better. I like owning the actual property better, but owning the property does require a little more effort. So if you're interested in paper investments, where you just basically earn an interest rate on a note, let us know about that, because we do have those available as well. Supply is not huge, but I know the inventory of properties is pretty constricted now, and everybody's complaining about it. You know, investors all over that I talk to, our clients, not our clients, are all saying, gosh, there's just not enough good properties to buy. Look, I get it. I get it. We're working on it. We're trying to get more inventory. As always, that has been the biggest challenge in our business over the last several years. Now, hey, it wasn't much of a challenge back during the Great Recession. Where were all of you buyers back then? Ah, I know you were waiting until it got better. Well, now it's better. So now, you know, it's never exactly balanced, right? The scales of inventory or supply versus demand, inventory versus investors, never quite balanced. So now we're in one of those imbalanced times because everybody and their brother wants to be buying income properties. So supply is limited. Work closely with your investment counselor and they will find you the deals the second they come on the market. Okay, let's get to our guest, Yaron Brook, and we've got Flashback Friday coming up in a couple days, and then Monday we've got a 10th episode show, and next Wednesday we're going to be back with some very practical, hands-on real estate investing lessons for you. Here's our guest. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Yaron Brook to the show. He is executive chairman of the Ayn Rand Institute, author of the best-selling book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. And I had the distinct pleasure to take an objectivism course at the Ayn Rand Institute in Irvine, California many years ago, and also meet Leonard Peikoff, who I believe was the sole heir to Ayn Rand's estate and been following this work for a long, long time. Yaron, why don't we start? Can I just ask you, who is John Galt?
I think at the end of the day, anybody who is willing to use their mind and be an independent thinker and be productive is a potential John Galt. So John Galt, at the end of the day, is the thinker in us, the rational man.
Fantastic. Well, that's a great explanation. You know, why is it, you know, if you can just speculate for a moment before we dig into some of the important topics of the day, why is it that Rand's work has been so incredibly popular and successful, especially during the Obama administration? There was this giant resurgence of Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead and probably all of her books. You know, it's just timeless work. What's behind it? Why is it so popular and powerful?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's timeless. And what makes it particularly popular and powerful is the extent to which she understood that ideas drive history and therefore could predict when she wrote these books in the 40s and 50s, she could predict that if the ideas in the culture did not change, that we would end up with something like the financial crisis and a president like Barack Obama. That is, she could tell where the culture was heading way before anybody else could, because she understood deeply the consequence of the ideas that go unchallenged by almost everybody, right or left, the consequence of those ideas in the political and cultural realms. So Atlas Shrugged, in many respects, predicts the world in which we have been living, and it predicts the primary conflicts in which we live. And presents, the positive is that it presents an alternative philosophy for living to the philosophy that the culture gives us. So usually you get these dystopian novels, and all they are bleak representations of the evil of authoritarianism. But they really never give you an alternative. They never say, okay, but here's how you should live so that this never happens. Atlas Shrugged was written so that Atlas Shrugged would never happen. And in that sense, you have to say that Ayn Rand failed in the sense that her ideas, while the books are very popular, the ideas have really not caught hold in the culture. And as a consequence, we continue to hold ideas that are devastating to all of us. And I think the financial crisis and Obama administration were just one relatively small example of that. But this is an ongoing problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. Well, you know, I agree with almost all of Rand's work, and I you know, not all of it, but most of it. And I've got to ask you, you know, in your time involved with the Ayn Rand Institute, with you know, all of this work, you've probably been interested in it, you know, since you came of age, I'm assuming. Are there any ideas you disagree with?
Not any philosophical ideas. No, I mean, I'm not a philosopher. It's kind of above my pay grade to really delve into that and really figure out if I disagree with anything. I haven't found anything. I don't disagree with the ethics, and I don't disagree with anything really in the political philosophy. I mean, certainly in particular applications of those ideas to particular events in history. I mean, I would love to know what you would be thinking now about whether it's a Trump administration or whether it's the response to 9/11 or a variety of different things. I try to use their ideas and apply them the best that I can, but application is hard. And when I look back at some of her writings about application, sure, there might be things here or there that I disagree with, but fundamentally her philosophy is a positive philosophy for living life and for how to live and be successful in life. And I have not found any flaws or contradictions or things that I disagree with on a principled level in any of her ideas with regard to ethics or political philosophy.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, good. Well, let's go ahead and dive into some maybe issues of the day, if you will. We have this huge contrast, this massive sea change in our political tides from Obama to Trump. I know what Ayn Rand would think about Obama, but what would she think about Trump?
Well, let me first say, I don't know what you would think. So to some extent, she was a genius. I am not. And it's hard to tell. She always came up with really original things to say about current events that I think at the time I could have never thought of. So I'm not going to speak for Ayn Rand. I'm going to speak for myself and I guess for the institution. And I would say that that what we're seeing in Obama and in Trump, in my view, are two variations on the same theme. So I see more similarity than difference. And I see the one as, in a sense, a response to the other. And by responding, it's a reflection of the other. Both, in my view, are fundamentally collectivists. Both are fundamentally in opposition to the founding ideas and the founding principles of America. Both have no understanding or really appreciation for the American Constitution and the founding documents. One approaches the collectivism from the left and from a certain hatred of America. And I think Barack Obama was the first anti-American president in history. I think he really disliked America. And the whole project of Obama was to turn America into kind of a satellite of Europe or another, you know, just another European country. His motto would be France. I think he had a certain resentment towards the founding fathers and the Constitution because it tied his hands. It restricted his ability to do things.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I would say to anybody who wants the U.S. to be more like Europe, go and visit Europe. Europe, and I was born in Germany, by the way. Europe is a disaster, okay? Everybody in Europe pretty much has a lesser life, at least from a material perspective. We can argue anything else you want, happiness scales or whatever. But from a material perspective, people in Europe have crappy little cars. They live in crappy little flats. They have, disastrous governments. Socialism does not work.
No, and you're absolutely right. And there's no question. And they have many, many problems. And as bad as things are in Europe today, things are going to get much worse in Europe before there's any semblance of a chance of them getting better. So we haven't seen the bottom yet. And I think we are following in those footsteps. Unfortunately, I think Barack Obama has been very successful. And I don't think it's just Obama. I think this has been a project of the left, and the right has done nothing to stop it for the last 50 years, turning the U.S. into Europe. And I think they've been to a large extent quite successful. And I think you can only understand the rise of Trump as a counterweight to exactly that. Trump is also European in a fundamental sense. He's much more similar to the European right than he is to the traditional American right. And in the sense that he is a nationalist and a collectivist, both things that are less American, they're less typical of the American political spectrum. Although, again, over the last 100 years, the whole country has become less American in the sense that we become more collectivist over time. You see, in my view, America is fundamentally what makes America America. It is its individualism, is the idea of the sanctity of the individual, the primacy of the individual. We set up a government not to make America great. We set up a government to protect individuals. And when you do that, when you leave people free, when government is limited not by some notion of Americanism or some notion of American greatness, but it's limited to the protection of individual rights. It's limited to the protection of the individual so that he can prosper. That's when you get the kind of material and I think spiritual success that Americans have had over the centuries. So I think that in that sense, Donald Trump is, again, not a completely American phenomena. He is about a different vision for government. He is about a vision of the government takes on the responsibility to manage, to decide what's good and what's bad for the citizenry, and to really to make America great again. When really what we want from government is to leave us alone. That's what really represents the American vision, and what differentiates America from Europe and every other place in the world is this, again, this notion of individual rights, this the moral foundation on which this country was founded.
Very good point, and well said. So dive a little more into Trump then, if you would, because you know Trump is he's a little bit hard to figure out. It's almost like a whole new political philosophy. I guess Obama was too, in a sense that he was sort of this socio-fascist, I kind of call him, you're welcome to disagree with me on any of this, but Obama was certainly, he leaned toward the left in terms of being a socialist, communist type thinker, but also, you know, in bed with the big corporations, which made him a fascist type thinker. So it was like an interesting mix, actually. What is Trump? I mean, can we define him?
Well, at the end of the day, I don't think, and listeners will be upset with me, I'm sure, I don't think there's that much difference. That is, I think that Donald Trump views himself as a CEO, and he wants to be the CEO of America. He wants to manage our lives, not in the way the socialist would manage them, towards some kind of equality. He wants to manage our lives in order to, I don't know, maximize some vision of American wealth and American production. But he believes it's a top-down type of management challenge. And he very much so he will call Carrier and say, Carrier, you shouldn't move jobs to Mexico. And by the way, if you do, I won't give United Technology the next defense contract. So he will use the levers of power in order to achieve his particular, since he used fascist before, fascist vision for America, which is different than Obama's fascist vision for America. But at the end of the day, it's the same methodology. It's to use the levers of power, to use government force to use government coercion in order to achieve a vision that he has for what American greatness looks like, rather than the founder's perspective, which was leave Americans free and Americans will become great. That is, America will become great. The purpose is not greatness. The purpose is freedom. Freedom, though, leads to greatness. And this is something neither left nor right understand anymore. They are all central planners. They are all little fascists, in a sense. They just have a different way. And what is unique to Trump, I think, is particularly in the way he ran his campaign, is that he has figured out how to manipulate, if you will, the American people. And this is an old technique that he has learned again from European authoritarians. And that is the technique of scaring them, creating a crisis through fear, then blaming not us, because ultimately, if you look around America, if there's a shortage of jobs, if there are problems in the economy, we cause them. We're the ones who are regulating everything. We're the ones who are taxing everything. We're the ones who are controlling everything. We vote for the people who do this. But don't blame us. No, it's not our fault. It's foreigners. It's immigrants and foreign governments from China to Japan to Korea to Mexico, even now Germany. It's their fault. And and this is the third leg of the kind of the authoritarian stool, I can solve the problem. Just give me power and I will put them in their place. And once I put them in their place, everything here will be good. Now he mixes into that also the idea of deregulation and reducing taxes. But those are not the essentials because he couldn't win on those. Republicans have tried and they don't seem to win on those. Those were secondary to the idea of if I build a wall and if I put up trade barriers, that'll really solve our problems. Now, I know you might disagree with this, but I believe that is a completely bogus argument. But it's one that worked politically and the one that has got him to where he is today.
Okay, so, how would you do that differently, all the stuff you said? I mean, don't you, if you're going to be the president, you have to make deals. So what else are you going to use to make a deal besides those levers of power you described, for example, with Carrier, right, to get them to stay and not take those jobs abroad?
But it's none of the government's business whether Carrier takes the jobs abroad or not. What you need to do as president of the United States, and this is the individualistic perspective on governing, is to eliminate the shackles on business and on an individual. So the priority needs to be not deregulate two for one like he's proposed. One regulation, every new regulation, you eliminate two. But what we should be doing is 0 to 200. That is, we shouldn't be adding any new regulations. We should be massively deregulating the U.S. economy. And we should be focusing on reducing taxes and doing it smartly and shrinking government spending. There's nothing more important, ultimately, than shrinking the very dollar-denominated size of government. Because the less the government spends, it means the more money is in the hands of individual Americans to shape their own lives. So if I were president, and, you know, that will never happen, but if I were president, my whole focus would be not on cutting deals with anybody other than Congress, where you have to cut deals, but to shrink government. What can I do today? Every single day you wake up in the morning and say, what can I do today to shrink the size, influence, control of government? I want to cut less deals. Cutting deals as president is exactly what fascism is. It's exactly what cronyism is. Government should have no involvement in the business life of business. If a business wants to move overseas, let it move overseas. The key is to create the friendliest, best environment for productive individuals in America. And you do that, again, by freeing up the market, by deregulating, and by shrinking government spending.
So all of the liberals will say, well, deregulation, isn't that what caused the financial crisis? We need to regulate these evil capitalists because they're going to do bad things if the government doesn't keep them in check. And of course, they are going to do bad things. I think we can all agree on that because none of us are angels. That's why we need a government.
some people, yeah. A small, tiny fraction of a minority will do bad things, and that's what we have the police for, and that's what we've had laws in the books against fraud forever. You don't need the mountains of regulation in order to catch Bernie Madoff. Indeed, I would argue, and I think I could prove this, that it is the mountains of regulation that prevented us from catching Bernie Madoff. They were way too busy reading my 13 D's and my 13 G's in order to actually go catch a crook. What interest does the government have in why I own 5% of any particular stock? Regulations have nothing to do with catching bad guys and indeed prevent us from catching the real bad guys.
Well, let me actually add to that and give you some more fuel for that argument. I would argue that regulations allow the bad guys to become big bad guys. And if you know, you listen, I say this all the time. If you watch the news, you'll hear the CEOs say, well, if the government will just get out of the way and stop regulating us. And they say that, right? That's the mantra. But secretly, they love those regulations because those are protectionist regulations that allow them to keep their monopolies. It makes it impossible for new players to enter. And here's an example of it. Just look around, folks. You can tell this just through your own common sense. You don't need to read a book on it. Tell me, who is the latest startup that is going to come and disrupt Goldman Sachs or any big bank or investment bank or any big Wall Street firm? There ain't any, because those are such highly regulated industries that the cost of compliance is impossible for a startup. Now, why do we see no startups and no disruption and no innovation in that world? We just see the entrenched powers keeping their power. Yet in the tech world, where there's virtually no regulation, I mean, nobody tells Facebook what color to put the button that you click on, right?
Not yet,
but it's coming.
But look, the same thing is true of the automobile industry. I mean, the internal combustion engine is pretty much the same today as it was 50 years ago. Airplanes are slower today than they were 30 years ago. So the latest 787 from Boeing is slower than the old 737, or the old 717.
And for fuel economy reasons.
Kinds of reasons. And the fact is that, the Concorde, which was the last innovation in air flight, we grounded. So absolutely any industry that you regulate is going to stagnate. Now, partially it'll stagnate because it doesn't allow for competition. And partially it stagnates because the human mind, human creativity, human innovation cannot flourish where there is force, where you are forced to think in a particular way, where you are forced to fill out these forms and not those forms, where you are forced to think within a box. The whole freedom leads to innovation because the human mind thrives under freedom, thrives where there's no authority to tell it what it must think and how it must think. So government regulations destroy innovation, destroy creativity, destroy productivity, not just because of the cronyism, but because of their very essence of bringing force to the table and restricting human ability to innovate, to be creative.
Yeah, very, very interesting point. Okay, we got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but any more on Trump's ideology? And then, you know, let's have a little debate about protectionism and so forth.
Sure. I mean, I think that Trump is basically countering Obama. So if Obama's fundamental ideology is a certain form of socialism, you know, with a fascist tinge, people forget that fascism, socialism, communism are all variations on the same thing. They're all variations of statism. So Obama's variation of statism is from the left. Donald Trump's variation of statism is from the right. But they're all collectivist. And what collectivism means is placing the group above the individual. In Obama's case, the group might be the downtrodden or the minorities or the LGBTQ community or whatever. And anybody, you could sacrifice anybody for that group. In Donald Trump's case, the group might be something that most Americans feel more sympathetic towards because the group is America. But it's still a group, and it's the opposite of the individualism. So we've got a right wing, if you will, statism of Trump versus a left-wing statism of Obama. And what I think is tragic is what we're missing is a true American, or we haven't had in a long time, a true American candidate, a candidate who runs on a platform of individualism, and that the whole basis for his politics is to free up individuals so they can pursue their happiness, so they can live their life the way they choose to live. And everything he does is focus on freeing up the individual, not on, on some collectivistic goal, not on some abstract make America great again, but on how do we make individuals in America have more control over their lives and be less dependent on government. And that would mean reforming welfare and Social Security and Medicare and in all of the regulations that we talked about. But it would be a comprehensive change to the way this country's structured. I think Donald Trump is going to make a change, but he's going to make a change more in the direction of state control of different things than what Obama would have had us control.
Yeah, very interesting. Would it be fair, and I think I already know the answer to your question, because this answer, when I took an objectivism class at the Ayn Rand Institute, the answer surprised me. Ayn Rand would not say she was a libertarian, would she?
No, she would not.
Yeah, she called them the hippies of the right, I think.
She did in the 70s. And if you go back and you look at the libertarian movement of the 70s, particularly in New York where she was living, she was very much right about the hippies of the right. But you know what she objected to was the fact that libertarian was a big tent term that included under the tent a lot of people that she resented. So, for example, the anarchists, they are libertarian, many libertarians today are considering themselves anarchists. And she considered that a disreputable kind of position to have, that anarchy was a very bad thing. And she would not want to be under a tent with anarchists. And the same would go for a bunch of other types of libertarianism that all had a variety of different philosophical foundations. She believed to defend liberty, you had to have one philosophical foundation that focused on individualism, on the morality of rational long-term self-interest, and a view of man as a rational animal, as being guided by reason. And she strongly believed that if you just agreed on liberty, you ultimately would undercut the case for liberty. If, for example, you approached your argument for liberty, let's say from a Marxist perspective, or from a religious Christian perspective, or from any other perspective, you needed to have a proper philosophical grounding. And libertarians was too big of a tent for her to want to belong to. She believed they undercut their own case for liberty. And you can see the Libertarian Party, to a large extent, doing exactly what she predicted they would do.
Yeah, very interesting. Tell us about altruism.
So altruism is the idea that you should live for the sake of other people, that your moral, ethical purpose in life is the well-being of your neighbor or some other group or anybody really who is in need or is doing less well than you are. So the standard for morality is how much you sacrifice for the sake of the needy. And she considered this morality, which is really the moral code that has been prevalent in the Western world for at least 2,000 years, she considered this moral code as an evil moral code. She would ask the simple question of why? Why is somebody else's life more important than mine? Why is somebody else's happiness more important than mine? And Ayn Rand very much rejected the whole morality of altruism. Now, she didn't view altruism, and I don't view altruism, as meaning being nice to people, being friendly, or even as being charitable. She was not against charity. She was not against being polite and being nice to people. She was against the idea that the moral purpose of your life is to serve other people. No, my moral purpose of my life is to live the best life that I can live, is to flourish, it's to be happy, it's the pursuit of happiness. And other people are often necessary for my pursuit of happiness. I trade with them, I enjoy them, I just enjoy human beings and human life generally, so I'm willing to be charitable towards helping people out. But it's because, right, my life is the standard that I want to help other people. I don't want to sacrifice and give up the things that I value for the sake of other people. I want other people to help me make my life better, just as they should want me to help their life better. And we call that trade, win-win transactions. sacrifice is by definition a win-lose transaction, and she was against that.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. That's a very good point. I know we've got to wrap up, and this is just a really interesting discussion, but just back to the concept of Trump and his trade policy, because I think that's really interesting. I remember Leonard Peikoff wrote a book or an article about why buying foreign...
Well, it was Harry Benswangen. He called it... Buy American is un-American.
That's it. Yeah, it wasn't Peikoff. Okay. And, you know, I think that book was written possibly back in the days when Japan was the big deal and to some the big threat, which they didn't turn out to be the big threat at all. And I really understood and agreed with a lot of that argument. Today, though, I find myself thinking that, you know, the American worker does need a little protection. And listen, I get the idea that it's great to get these foreign products at low prices. I love it. You know, you go shopping, everything's cheaper, blah, blah, blah. And it makes our quality of life better in many ways. But it seems like the trade war is really about, you know, this choice. And maybe it's not. So correct me if I'm wrong. But it's a choice between, do you want high-paying American jobs like we used to have, or do you want low-priced products?
So to me, that's clearly a false choice, and it doesn't. There's nothing in reality that suggests that that is true. So let's start with the idea that somehow China is taking our jobs. It's just not true. Every economic analysis of the loss of manufacturing jobs in America shows that over 90% of the lost jobs are lost because of technology. We produce today, in terms of actual stuff, twice as many goods, in terms of units produced, twice as many goods as we did when we had max people working in production, which was 1979. So since 1979, the number of people working in the manufacturing industries has declined, while the number of things that we actually produce, the number of widgets out the factory door, has increased dramatically. And the reason for that is simple. The reason for that is technology, robots, computers, and in the future, it's going to be artificial intelligence. And that's just the reality, and nothing you do about China or any of these other countries makes one iota of difference. I'd actually argue the opposite. What trade does is it creates immense numbers of jobs in the United States, and it creates great jobs in the United States. I don't believe Silicon Valley would be as productive and successful and as high paying as it is today if not for free trade. You couldn't produce iPhones and all, imagine all the jobs that are involved in iPhones in the United States, and good, high paying jobs.
And not only that, the benefits that the United States economy has had from smartphones, because we use them to make ourselves more productive.
And yet, if you didn't have the global international supply chain, where tariffs globally are at the lowest rate they have ever been in human history, even though they're higher in China than they are here, they're still lower than they've ever been on average ever. You couldn't have that global supply chain as efficient and as productive as it is without these trade deals.
I get everything you're saying. My only skepticism is this. You know, when the playing field is so unlevel, when Chinese businesses don't have to work under OSHA, high minimum wage requirements, the EPA, you know, this is not a level playing field. The U.S. companies are so overregulated.
So let's do it, right? So the solution to that is not tariffs. It's not trade barriers. It's getting rid of the stupid regulations. I agree with you.
I agree completely.
Labor laws, and California will become the richest place in the world. You know, get rid of the labor laws, the EPA laws, get rid of all this stuff. But tariffs, all tariffs are a tax on consumption. So if you raise tariffs, it's a lose-lose proposition. In America, we lose because all goods, including American-made goods, will be more expensive. And of course, the Chinese lose because they lose some of our business. Everybody loses from it. There is no winner from tariffs. You want American jobs, and this goes back to my initial thing. Let me also say this. At the end of the day, trade is not between countries. America doesn't trade with China. This is, again, the individualistic perspective. I buy stuff that happens to be made in China. I'm trading with some Chinese guy who's making the stuff thousands of miles away. The government has no business in telling me I should have to pay a higher rate to buy it from China because China doesn't regulate their businesses like we in America. I mean, I as an individual go to my government and would say, well, then stop regulating our businesses. Why are you penalizing me?
Well, I agree with that, but you're not going to
change. You're doing something stupid.
I agree completely, but you're not going to change that anytime soon. I mean, that's going to be a long
road. Well, but tariffs are not a solution. Tariffs are lose-lose. We all lose if we have tariffs. And so we get stuck with the same stupid regulations. And on top of that, we load on a consumption tax. That is not a solution to anything.
Yeah, very interesting. Give out your website. Tell people where they can find out more about you.
Ayn Rand.org, AynRand.org. I've also got a regular podcast, Yaron Brooks, so that's YaronBrook. Just put my name in any podcasting software. And the book, Equal is Unfair. You can get it on Amazon or pretty much anywhere else books are sold.
Fantastic. Dr. Yaron Brook, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason. It was fun.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.